From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Ecological horticulturist Andy Brand can't help himself. He just has to look closely at everything outdoors, every plant, every insect, every process that's unfolding. And he has to take camera phone pictures too, lots and lots of pictures. These up-close observations aren't just visually compelling, though. They also pull him down a rabbit hole of inquiry about who or what he's looking at and what's going on anyhow and why. Nature's endless fascinations and what they can teach us if we allow ourselves the time to explore is our topic today. More in a moment, but first, these messages.
Underwriting support from Color Blends, supplying top-quality spring-blooming Dutch flower bulbs to landscape professionals and ambitious home gardeners. More information on the web, colorblends.com. Programming and underwriting support from Royal Botanic Gardens, publishers of Kew Pocketbooks, small gift books illustrated from Kew's vast collection of botanical art. The most recent book, Fungi, about the strange and singular world of mushrooms, toadstools, and their kin. In bookstores now.
Andy Brand, who worked for many years at the rare plant specialty nursery called Broken Arrow in Connecticut, has since 2018 been at Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens, where he is director of horticulture, managing its big picture garden scenes while he also savors the tiny ones, which he shares on Instagram. He's here today to encourage us all to slow down and have a closer look and to share some of the ahas he's learned about nature along the way. Hi, Andy. I'm so glad to talk to you as ever.
Hi, Margaret. It's great to be back.
Yes. So I was thinking, let's do a giveaway of one of your new calendars with the transcript of this show over on awaytogarden.com. You've at Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens, they've taken some of your fabulous pictures and made greeting cards and calendars now and all kinds of things. So let's have a giveaway. So we'll
that would be awesome.
So I'll get one of those for some lucky reader and commenter. So we'll do that.
Great.
So the backstory of our conversation today was we recently worked together on a really popular story for the New York Times for my garden column that captured people's attention. And, it was kind of about your looking closer, like I said in the introduction, and the iPhone photos that you take and share on social media. And when we talked then, you said something like this. You said that your hope was not just to put a bunch of pretty pictures out there, but hopefully get people inspired to learn more. And you also said, when you look at things, it's not just like, oh, look, this is this. It's like you say, I wonder what it was doing last season. I wonder how long it lives. I wonder, Tell us about your process, your thing, what's going on for you out there.
Since that article went out, it has been really, truly amazing, the feedback that I've received, just wonderful comments from people, just some people that are doing similar things, taking the time, but others that are, inspired now to actually take the time when they're out in a field or taking a hike and not just going from point A to point B as quickly as they can. That's not the main purpose when I go out anyhow. And it's truly fascinating to me how I can spend endless hours in this 3/4 acre field next to my house and see so many different things every day. And it's amazing. It could be the same insect, but a different day it's doing something totally different. And I'm the type that I just need to spend the time and watch it. What is it doing? Why is, why is that butterfly hanging from that flower in a weird position? And so you get in closer and sure enough, there's a spider that has caught that butterfly.
Wow.
And it's just, then starts the brain going, thinking about, the whole, how everything is connected. And, we need the spiders to control populations of insects. And, without spiders, which I know many people don't like, but they serve an amazing purpose in our whole ecosystem that we live in.
Yes, a spider expert I once spoke to from a university out west said something like, without spiders, there could be no life on the planet. They provide such an important, there's so many of them, and they provide such an important pest control, so to speak, balancing role
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So even in just coming across a spider who had that butterfly, then you can go down a whole tunnel of learning and so forth. And you allow yourself to do that.
Yeah. Oh, it's pretty much endless, you know. It's just, you, and then that leads to something else. And, you know, maybe while you're watching that spider, your eye gets quickly drawn to something else that's going on in that same, you know, patch of goldenrods that you've been watching.
Right. Well, when we did the time story, I mean, one thing, and it just had never occurred to me to even look for it. And maybe it's because I live in an upland site and I'm not around like ponds and I'm not a kayaker or whatever like that. I'm not around the edge of water a lot in my current life. Mm-hmm. But you showed a picture, you told me about, and you showed a picture of one phase in the dragonfly's life. So, you know, we all see them in gardens, we see them flying around, but they have this close relationship to water, right?
They do. I mean, they spend majority of their lives in water, you know, as they're in the nymph stage. And then, you know, once they get to the final, you know, mature stage, they crawl out onto some of the emergent vegetation around a pond edge or stream or onto rocks, some type of substrate. And then the adult emerges from this, what's called an exuvae. And it's then the adult emerges and you're left with this perfect shell of that nymph stage of the dragonfly. And, you know, I caught one, I think the one you're talking about is the exuvae photo. It was on a cattail leaf.
Right.
And the sun was just right and it reflected on the water and it just led to a really cool picture. And, you know, you can see the eyes of on the exuvae and where the wings were forming and everything. And it just totally fascinates me to see that and then start thinking about this creature that was living in water for all these months and now is this total amazing acrobat in the sky, you know, hawking all the mosquitoes in my yard, hopefully.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it molted, right? And that's a thing that with so many insects, you know, there's various stages of metamorphosis and some are complete and some have fewer stages and soap phases or whatever. But the molting and I remember the first time I love millipedes and we have the big one here in the Northeast as in many areas, the Narcissus americanus, the giant millipede.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, and I just love it. It's sort of this taupe, brownish taupe colored long creature. And it has kind of, like Chinese lacquer red, little like orangey red, little tiny markings along each segment. It has lots of legs, of course. And
right.
Anyway, you know, and I know them, the full grown ones, I know them. And then once I saw something that looked like one, but it was so much smaller and it was on the wall of the house. It was like crawling up the house. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what's that? And I did what you tell me to do, you know, you've taught me to do, which is I went and researched and sure enough, they look identical throughout their life, but they like molt, you know, as they become adults, they molt and they leave behind, right? An old shell, so to speak. Yeah. And so it was just a youngster. It was like a miniature.
Yeah, it is. It's totally fascinating. And like I said, every day it's just always something new and different.
One time when you visited my garden years ago, we were doing, I think, a program together. We were walking in the garden and you like said, oh, look at that, you know, such and such caterpillar. And I was like, what? Huh? You know?
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
Right. And it was a caterpillar that looked like a stick and it was on a twiggy branch, you know, branch of a tree, of a shrub. Mm-hmm. And it just looked like another twig, and the common name is stick caterpillar, and of some moth, a geometrid moth, I guess. And you saw it right away. So that was like hiding in plain sight, that sort of cryptic thing. So I think a lot of your images are about that too.
They are, and you know, that leads me to start looking at other things, and you start looking at how do you know caterpillars defend themselves, and you know, camouflage is a big way, and if you look at some of, you know, the caterpillars on the trees in your yard, there are some have markings. They look like the edge of a leaf that's been chewed by other insects. You know, if you put that next to the chewed part of a leaf, that caterpillar would almost mimic the exact colors of that chewed leaf. And, you know, the stick caterpillar, it does look like a short cut off, broken off branch. You know, and it's just so amazing that these creatures have evolved to find these ways to protect themselves by being eaten by birds or some other type of predator, or, you know, hide from parasitic wasps or flies.
Right, to hide in plain sight, you know, mm-hmm. to go about their eating and other things without being eaten.
Right.
Right. And so many moths, I mean, so many moths, you know, we see all those moths, they're sort of nondescript looking. They're not wildly patterned, colorful or whatever. And, you know, because they spend the daytime when somebody might find them and gobble them up, they spend the daytime on rocks or bark of a tree or, you know, some of them on moss and they kind of look like that. And, you know, they have the pattern of where they want to hide in daylight a lot of
times. Yeah. And I think for me too, I for some of these insects that, you know, I just, being in the nursery industry for so long, you know, I never had an affection for like borer insects.
I wonder why.
And so many of them, you know, are moths, you know, and like a lot of these really fancy looking moths that I didn't know until I saw one time neck on a flower, and I didn't know what it was. So took obviously lots and lots of photos and then, you know, figured out what it was. And I was just totally amazed. It was the most delicate, you know, furry moth. And, you know, it did not look like your normal moth, but, you know, it had clear spots in its wings and it had these really elaborate antennae and very furry legs. And, you know, that just made me want to look for other types of borer insects, you know. And, you know, we've talked before about sawflies. And how much we love sawflies, even though they destroy my pines and birch and such. But they're incredibly fascinating group of creatures. I think, you know, I just recently posted something sawfly because I saw this tiny little insect look like a small wasp, which sawflies are related to wasps, same family, and it turned out to be a female birch sawfly. And I thought she was just sitting on a leaf, but then when I got down closer and started taking photos, I realized that she was actually laying eggs all along the margin of this birch leaf. And there was just these little pockets. You could see that she inserted an egg between the layers of the leaf. And it was just, again, one of those moments where it's like, wow, this is unbelievable, you know, that this is going on right here in this 2 foot tall birch tree in my field next to my house.
Well, and that each species has these very specific, in the same way that, you know, each bird species has a nest type. And I always wonder, how did the next generation learn to make this shape of size of nest? You know what I mean? My mind is just blown by those questions. Like, Where's the book that taught them how to do this? Right. You know what I mean?
Who handed down
this knowledge? Like, is it genetically coded or something? And and you know, and so you see these things and you think things like that. But so speaking of things that kind of hiding in plain sight, or you know, being cryptic, or mm-hmm. or you know, physical appearance and how it serves creatures in the world. You just posted on Instagram I think it was a fly that looks like a hornet, but it's not a hornet or whatever. Yeah, this sort of mimicry thing going on, right?
Yeah, mimicry. That's another, you know, as you said, rabbit hole that you can go down and stay there for quite a while. And I've seen these flies before, but you know, every year I can't help myself but take another photo, and you know, because you can always get a different angle, different shot, you know, close up of the eyes. And it's a type of fly. It's called the bald-faced hornet fly, and as the name suggests, it is an amazing mimic of the nasty bald-faced hornet that, you know, builds those big paper nests that you often see, and that used to terrorize me when I was at the nursery. You know, you were expecting accidentally get too close to one, and you know, they would hunt you down.
They protect their home base for sure.
They're very good protectors. But this fly just, you know, it's black and white. It's got the markings on there. Its abdomen that look like the hornet. But it has two wings, you know, Diptera, which is the, you know, what flies are in. They're classified in the Diptera. So Diptera referring to the two wings as opposed to four wings of the hornets. So that's a good way to tell. But, you know, you can tell a little bit the way it flies that it's not a hornet, but sitting on a flower or on a leaf from a somewhat of a distance, it definitely has the look of that hornet.
So if I'm a fly, why do I want to look like a hornet?
Protection.
So it says to some bird who might want to bite me and swallow me, it says, I'm going to hurt you.
That's right. Yeah. And, you know, there are others that mimic bumblebees. I may post one eventually. I want to see if I can take more photos of it. It's a little small, but it's black and yellow, which, you know, the striping on the abdomen and looks just like a small bumblebee. And then another fascinating insect that I actually had never seen until I moved to Maine, and I think they're around, is called a mantis fly. And it looks like the cross between a praying mantis and a wasp. I mean, it has these front legs that look like the front legs of a praying mantis. And it flies, you know, it's the coloration of a paper wasp. And it mimics a paper wasp. It has the striping, some subtle striping on the abdomen. Flies just like a wasp, but looks like this creature that should not belong here. It's totally fascinating. I spent hours following it, trying to get decent photos of it.
That coloration, that sort of often black and yellow. I think they say aposomatic coloration, that warning coloration, is kind of a universal signal to predators that you don't want to bite me, you don't want to taste me, I'm not good to eat.
Right.
In fact, I might hurt you, you know, kind of, right?
It's
sort of a universal, the way we have black and yellow road signs. It always makes me laugh, you know, that we have those black and yellow, you know, like for curves in a road or warning or whatever, you know, we use the same color.
I know, isn't it? That's true.
Oh, yeah. So let's talk about some plants. You have an obsession with plants, obviously. I mean, you started out in school, you actually even studied micropropagation, tissue culture, you know, speaking of tiny little bits of things to look at, you know, laboratory kind of microscope kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But you have a particular obsession with, and I mean that in a loving way, Andy, not critical, with plants of the spring woodland, I think, including Epimedium. I mean, you've grown how many different kinds of Epimedium?
Over 150, probably.
Because you couldn't help yourself?
You know, it's just one of those, I just fell in love with them. And, you know, they were easy to grow. They grew in the conditions I had, you know, dry shade. And they flowered early. They had really awesome foliage. You know, some were spreading ground covers, some were clump formers, some were pretty much evergreen through good part of December, January in Connecticut. The deer didn't eat them for the most part, which was always a benefit. And they were just, you could plant them and, you know, with very little care, have great success with them. And they're just, you know, I was always fascinated with, you know, when Dan Hinckley from Heronswood and Daryl Probst from Garden Vision, you know, they were brought in so many awesome new species that they introduced from their marvelous travels in Asia, various parts. And that, I think that whole story kind of sucked me into them as well. And I just, they literally, no pun intended, grew on me. And I just had to, you know, each one and, you know, it's just a great, great hobby to collect those. I do love, I'm fond of woodland plants in general.
Yeah.
A lot of spring ephemerals.
Yeah. And lately, or not lately, but, you know, and additionally, you're a lover of milkweeds, like monarch butterflies. You're a lover of milkweeds. And you were talking to me about how There's a milkweed species for so many different habitats. It's not just of the meadow, so to speak, you know.
And that's what I really, that's what I really love about them. You know, you can, you know, for the most part, many of them really do prefer full sun situations, and, you know, some are spreading that are pretty aggressive, you know, like our native, you know, Syriaca, the common milkweed that you see in meadows throughout the region. But the butterfly weed, Asclepias tuberosa, the bright orange flowered, wonderful plant, you know, a couple feet tall, grows in meadows, you know, wonderful nectar plant for not just monarchs and other butterflies, but all kinds of types of pollinators. I learned about poke milkweed, Asclepias exaltata, which actually does well in like high canopy shade situations.
Oh.
Actually, when you find it in the wild, that's a typical situation where you'll find it is under, it'll tolerate some shade, which was great. And, you know, then you have swamp milkweed, which, you know, if you have a wet site in your yard, perfect. And then you can get into a lot of, there's so many species, you know, native to other parts of the U.S. that are kind of fun to try with interesting flowers. And then the, you know, the seed pods are pretty fascinating.
Well, and that's what I want to spend our last four or five minutes on. I want to talk about seed dispersal, because some of the photos, besides your crazy photos of like in the winter of like the bubbles in a puddle on the ground, the frozen puddle, and all these faces that you see in the ice and things like that, which just are great. And some of your photos of reflections in water and so forth. But ones that I love in particular are of seed dispersal, of as you say, taking flight, like the milkweed pod opening and like the seed taking flight and those types of journeys of the next generation and so forth. So let's just talk a little bit about seed dispersal. That is a fascination of yours, right?
It is. And, you know, it's, you know, in milkweeds, you know, that is pretty amazing. And with the milkweeds, I played a lot with lighting with those and, you know, trying to backlight the pods as they were splitting open and those seeds were starting to, you know, emerge from those pods. And, you know, they're very light and fluffy. They have like almost like parachutes when they take off and slightest wind takes them and gets them up high into the air. But, you know, backlit, they just shine and they have this kind of silky texture to them that sometimes you get multicolors in that silk, which is quite fascinating to me, the way the maybe it's a combination of the lighting and the camera. But that just takes you thinking about how other seeds are dispersed. And, you know, you can look at lupins, you know, here in Maine, lupins are everywhere for the most part. And they split open and actually their seeds kind of get tossed a little bit as they split open, and then they twist and they look almost like a helix the way they dry the seed pods, you know, and there's these perfect black seeds inside. And you know, in the garden looking at Jeffersonia, you know, and that has a really fascinating seed capsule. It's this capsule with replaces the flower, and it has this rim that as the seed capsule matures, it opens up and it reveals these mahogany shiny seeds inside, this cup-like structure, and that cap lifts off this hinge, and then the seeds are just, you know, as the stem breaks down a little bit more, the wind blows, these seeds are then dispersed onto the ground, you know, for the next generation to begin to germinate and start the following spring. But it's just amazing the different techniques that plants use to, you know, how those pods open up and, you know, to catch them in different times, you know, just starting to open, fully open. You know, I love dandelions, you know, for their early flowers, for pollinators, you know, when the first flowers for so many of our early bees species are native bees. But, you know, when you look at that perfect brown seed head, you know, when you look at it close, which a lot of my photos are pretty, you know, close macro photos, it's gorgeous. And then put some different sunlight on it from different angles, and it just they take on this just beautiful character to them. And it makes you think, you know, when you see those milkweed seeds flying, it's like, where is that going to eventually end up? And, you know, is it going to germinate and start a new patch somewhere else? Or is it going to be eaten by some small mammal? Who knows? But that's the way my brain is thinking when I, you know, it's not just looking at them and taking a photo, but just like, what's going to happen with these seeds? What's their journey?
Well, indeed. And what's the journey of those of us human types going out into the world and maybe slowing down our journey and bothering to look and taking some pictures and so forth. So, I mean, we're out of time, but I just want to say that we should be taking time to do, you know, follow your inspiration. I'm going to give, besides the information on the giveaway with the transcript of the show over on awaytogarden.com, the giveaway of your calendar, of your image, some of your images, I'm going to also give lots of pictures and lots of links where people can find you on Instagram. Are you Andy J. Brand? Is that right?
Yes, that's
at
it.
Andy J. Brand.
Yeah, I'd love to get people's
meet more people
comments.
And, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I try to respond to a lot of people when I can, just because I enjoy that. And I enjoy people's enthusiasm for the natural world.
Well, thanks for turning us on to it today. And I hope I'll talk to you again soon.
Programming and underwriting support from Royal Botanic Gardens, publishers of Kew Pocketbook, Small Gift Books Illustrated from Kew's vast collection of botanical art. The most recent book, Fungi, about the strange and singular world of mushrooms, toadstools, and their kin. In bookstores now.
I hope so. Yes. Thank you, Margaret.
Underwriting support from Color Blends, supplying top quality spring blooming Dutch flower bulbs to landscape professionals and ambitious home gardeners. More information on the web, colorblends.com.
And I hope I'll talk to all the rest of you again soon, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening and slowing down to look closely in the meantime.
Away to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.